From the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University, this is Trending Globally. I'm Dan Richards. On July 26th, military forces in the West African country of Niger staged a coup, forcing the country's president, Mohamed Bazoum, out of power. This is not the first coup in Niger's recent history, or in the recent history of the Sahel region of Africa more broadly. In the last few years, there have been coups in Burkina Faso, Mali, Chad, but this one, in Niger, has the West especially on edge. But according to our guest today, while this coup is of course worth paying attention to, it's not for the reasons you've maybe heard. On this episode, what we in the West get wrong about the politics of Niger and its neighboring countries, and how to reframe our thinking about this part of the world in order to actually help create a more stable and peaceful West Africa. To understand why this summer's coup caught the U.S. off guard and has caused so much concern among Western countries, you have to understand a little bit more of the backstory of the U.S.'s recent relationship with Niger. The story of this relationship, as it exists today, really started after 9/11. At that time, Niger was a democratic government, and the U.S. saw it as a potentially valuable ally in the Bush administration's
so-called global war on terror.
That's Stephanie Savelle. She is a co-director of the Costs of War Project at the Watson Institute and an expert on U.S. military efforts in West Africa. She's going to be our guide through all this. As she put it,
this has been a partner that the U.S. has had since the early days following 9/11.
The U.S. and other Western nations, including, among others, Germany and France,
were all helping Niger in various ways with different types of security assistance and, you know, and kind of saying, well, we're really helping prop up and support this democratic regime.
In an area gripped by political instability, poverty, and violence, Niger was seen as
the last hope for Western governments in claiming some sort of prevention of a broader conflict starting up.
The U.S. and its allies were providing Niger with military assistance and training, but it was more than that. We were exporting a specific way of looking at the world and at global security.
At the time, 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005, the U.S. was creating security partnerships all across this West Africa region, again, as part of this so-called global war on terror. So the idea at the time, according to Bush era officials, was they were going to go in and kind of stabilize the places where terrorism could potentially emerge to threaten the United States. So it was preemptive war, really. This was the American framework.
This militarization and preparation for war set Niger and its neighbors up for something more like actual war in 2011. This began not in Niger, but in the country's neighbor to the north, Libya.
A revolution exploded there just over a week ago.
Muammar Gaddafi, the leader who ruled Libya for four decades by crushing the opposition, could himself be crushed by a popular uprising.
This noise is the reaction to the official statement now from the National Transitional Council of Libya, the confirmation that Colonel Gaddafi, in fact, has been killed today in his hometown of Sirte.
Gaddafi's death created a power vacuum in Libya, which led to civil war and ultimately chaos in the entire region.
There were a bunch of kind of mercenary forces and a lot of arms that filtered down through the Sahara Desert, which is a really porous, you can picture, I mean, there are country borders, but it really is, you know, a desert region. And so there are vehicles going back and forth across borders all the time.
Weapons and violence spread from Libya to Niger, Burkina Faso, Mali. In other words,
a snowball effect. There were these separatist movements in Mali that joined forces with some of the former mercenaries. A lot of them were, you know, similar ethnic groups. And that led to Mali's destabilization. There was a coup, and the kind of militant terror attacks began spreading from Mali to this tri-border region of Niger and Burkina Faso.
The U.S. saw this upheaval as a dangerous training ground for Islamist militant groups. So they invested even more money in the region, especially in Niger.
Just since 2012, the U.S. had given Niger $500 million in security assistance, about $150 million in arms sales in just the last 5 years to Niger. And then the U.S. built a base in Agadez, which is in the north part of the country, really at the southern end of the Sahara Desert. That was a $110 million construction project. It's a very sophisticated construction. It's the second only official base in all of Africa, although the U.S. has many more. This is a really significant installation. So drones from the airbase are circulating and providing surveillance and reconnaissance and intelligence to governments around the region and the United States, around the Sahel band and the Sahara Desert region to the north, Libya, Algeria, Tunisia. And U.S. taxpayers pay about $20 to $30 million per year just to maintain that base.
Along with money and resources, praise has also been heaped onto the country by the U.S. This past March, Anthony Blinken became the first sitting Secretary of State to visit Niger in the country's history.
Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, he had visited Niger in March, and he called the country
a model of resilience, a model of democracy, a model of cooperation. It's one that we deeply value and deeply respect.
4 months later, Niger's president was ousted by military forces in the country. You can see then why Niger's recent instability has caused such a stir in the United States. It's left U.S. officials, observers of international affairs, and security experts with a lot of questions. Questions like, how did this model of democracy, which has received so much support from the U.S., fall so easily? And what does its fall mean for international security against Islamist militant groups? And then, zooming out even further, what does this coup mean for the tensions that exist and are growing between the US and Russia, two global powers that are competing to gain influence across Africa today? These are, according to Stephanie, exactly the wrong questions to be asking. And in fact, looking at politics in the Sahel region through these lenses might make things worse. So let's take a look at where these frameworks come from and why they are so counterproductive. And then we'll take a look at what Stephanie thinks might be a better way to think about peace and stability in the Sahel region. The first thing Stephanie thinks we need to set straight is that despite the praise of Secretary Blinken and others, over the last decade,
Niger was not the kind of stronghold of democracy that the U.S. was making it out to be.
During President Bazoum's time in power, there were a lot of red flags regarding the state of the country's democracy, including the existence of
what they called states of emergency, which the government had declared in certain regions along the borders of the country. And in those zones of emergency, the government forces were authorized to essentially treat anyone on a motorcycle, which is the signature vehicle of these Islamist militant groups, to treat them as an enemy and shoot, essentially, anyone out past curfew. There were some marketplaces that were being shut down in one region. Fishing was prohibited and growing certain crops. This was kind of a counterinsurgency tactic to kind of get, you know, the root of people's economic livelihood sources, kind of attack those with the idea that militant groups were kind of coming out of these regions.
Stephanie saw other signs of anti-democratic tendencies in the country when she visited Niger this past January.
every journalist almost that I spoke with, every political activist that I spoke with had faced jail time or was being prosecuted at the moment by the government. So the government was really cracking down even on democratic political dissent. You know, and there was just these kind of really strong ethnic tensions that were kind of had been there a long time because there was so much kind of political turmoil and elites who are kind of battling for power. And, you know, the military had a very strong role already in political life. So there was all these kinds of, you know, instability that was already in the works.
Which in many ways made Niger not so different from its neighboring countries, despite its reputation in the West.
This is actually Niger's fifth successful coup since independence in the 1960s. So this country has a long history of coups. And the U.S. pours these hundreds of millions of dollars into the military. The military budget in Niger and Burkina Faso, where I've studied, has just kind of gone up exponentially since early 2012, 2013, 2014. And so this just contributes to this skewing of the balance of power and this, you know, kind of overimportance of the military in these countries' governments. And I think that also contributes to the pattern of coups. So there was all these kinds of, you know, instability that was already in the works that people who were observing closely were, you know, could have seen this coming.
And as Stephanie puts it,
I think the U.S. was really willfully blind to a lot of its more authoritarian tendencies.
So that was one misunderstanding, that Niger was in fact this shining beacon of democracy. Another misunderstanding is just how important Niger's security is to the West's security. As I put it to Stephanie,
so I guess just one question I have is, you know, are there international terrorist organizations in this region of the Sahel that are threats to the United States and the West?
So there's two parts to your question. Are they an international threat is one question. Are they, you know, affiliated with other movements in other parts of the world? So the yes is the answer to the second. These groups are kind of increasingly affiliated with the Islamic State in the Greater Sahara and Al-Qaeda as well. So there's been, you know, kind of local groups affiliating with these terror groups that we've seen in the Middle East. And that hasn't been just random. There's been intentional movement on the part of the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda to kind of spread in this region. Do they pose an international threat? You know, can they threaten U.S. interests? I mean, that is not for me to say necessarily. I'm not a security strategist, right? I'm an anthropologist. So, but it's hard to imagine these groups launching an attack anywhere else in the world. The kind of bulk of the men who make up these groups in these regions are really just poor farmers and people who are joining these groups for any number of reasons. But, you know, one of the really essential things to know is that this instability, it's really rooted in structural causes.
What exactly do you mean by that? Structural causes?
This is a region that's incredibly impoverished. Niger is the seventh poorest country in the world. And there is so much rage at the legacy of colonialism and the injustice that that has meant in terms of people's lives. You know, people outside the capital have very little access to any kind of infrastructure or government services like schools and healthcare. There are no jobs to be had. And then you throw into the mix that this is one of the regions of the world that has seen the impacts of climate change most seriously up until this point. Desertification, people's livelihoods are changing. There's been increasing tensions between farmers and herders over land use as the desert has kind of crept into the kind of more arable land. So there's just a ton of these kinds of factors at play. People are frustrated with also with, you know, government corruption. And we have to kind of understand this conflict as having really being rooted in these sorts of issues.
If that's the main story we in the West are getting wrong, that Niger was a beacon of democracy and an essential front line in protecting U.S. interests abroad, there's also a sort of subplot, and the subplot is one that we are also getting wrong. Here's Stephanie.
A lot of the international and U.S. media attention to Niger's coup has come in the context of what the U.S. calls great power competition with Russia and China. So Secretary Blinken's visit to Niger has to be understood against the backdrop of what the U.S. sees is a struggle with Russia and China over which countries in Africa are going to be U.S. allies and going to align politically with the U.S. and which are going to align politically with Russia or China. I've seen it all over the place. New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, they're all saying, oh, you know, if Niger is no longer a U.S. ally, is it going to go over to Russia? Well, you know, it's just kind of a really misleading way of looking at the situation.
And this sort of neo-Cold War or great power framing of Niger's coup, it sort of misses how Niger actually interacts with other countries. And it makes the U.S. the center of a story that it's not really the center of.
It's an overlooking of the fact that people in Niger and other countries in the region are very much their own agents. They're the ones making the decisions about whether they're going to partner with a particular foreign power like the U.S. or Russia or China. And from what I can understand in interviewing high-level government officials and military, you know, members of the military in Niger and Burkina Faso, they are making decisions based on what's politically expedient at the time. So they might say that they're going to, you know, partner with the U.S. and receive $100 million in security assistance, and they might get some weapons from China, and they might also, you know, get some grain deal from Russia, right? So they are going to use all of this security assistance and other assistance to their advantage in the way that they see. And I think the coup really bears this out. I mean, if it were the case that the U.S. were able to buy political alignment through, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of assistance, the U.S. would have succeeded in doing so. And instead, the coup leaders chose to lead a coup and willingly kind of give up the opportunity to continue securing U.S. assistance. So clearly there's other things going on. And I think when the U.S. media and government officials like Blinken portray this as a kind of a battle over Africa, these are, you know, just really stale ideologies. They lend themselves again to this kind of militarized Cold War framework.
Now, this doesn't mean that international affairs and the tensions between the U.S., Russia and China have no bearing on what we are seeing in Niger today. And it's worth understanding those dynamics in their more complex and messy reality. Here's Stephanie.
Certainly there is a geopolitical component. Putin is making moves in Africa. He had a summit several months back where he invited a bunch of African leaders. He is offering some grain deals to gain political alignment through economic concessions. So, and, you know, and China has been building infrastructure and securing access to a lot of mines, of natural resources, which this region is really rich in for many years.
These aren't just inaccurate ways of looking at this conflict. According to Stephanie, they're actually harmful. They are counterproductive, and they will likely lead to more violence, not less, in the region.
There is a way in which you can see this as a kind of geopolitical struggle of importance, but the effective response on the part of the U.S. is not a militarized one. This coup is really a wake-up call to the United States to reassess its policy and to not just pay lip service to the fact that development and diplomacy should take primacy as, you know, U.S. foreign policy vehicles, but to actually really make it happen in practice. And I think there is still, unfortunately, a real disconnect between what the U.S. government says it's learned about what is successful in foreign policy objectives in Africa, and the fact that when you kind of look at what's happening on the ground, a lot of times it's the kind of Pentagon's militarized approach that's taking priority.
And the problem is not just the funding and the resources that the U.S. provides to Niger. Like Stephanie talked about at the beginning of the episode, it's the mindset we are exporting as well. And it's how the U.S. communicates its values to the world and, of course, to the people of Niger. As Stephanie described it when she visited the country this past January.
It was very clear that, you know, everyone I spoke with in Niger knew that the American drones were offering surveillance to the government in the kind of fight against these terror groups. And no one talked about the fact that the U.S. actually spends more money on humanitarian assistance to Niger or has. So there's a really kind of fundamental problem with the communications and the narrative around what it is that the U.S. is doing in relation to these governments.
Is that the case that the U.S. actually spends more money on non-military based humanitarian investment?
Yeah, it does. It's hard to get an exact figure, but it seems that there's been over $200 million per year that the U.S. has spent in humanitarian and development aid. So again, that's $200 million per year compared with what I was talking about is $500 million since 2012 on security assistance. So it is quite a bit more money spent on humanitarian aid. But it, again, that's just not something that anyone knows about.
I want to talk more about that. But first, I want to go back to where we started, to the coup that occurred this summer. So we've now looked at a bunch of different ways that it's been discussed and analyzed and fretted over in the U.S., most of which are perhaps inaccurate and even harmful. But I guess I wonder, what's your sense of what this coup actually means for the people who are most affected by it, the people living in Niger?
What we've seen in Burkina Faso and Mali is that the violence is just getting worse. The military-led governments in those countries are continuing this very repressive war on the Islamist militant groups. They are in turn committing more terror attacks, and the kind of cycle of violence is just intensifying. It wouldn't be surprising if that's what happened in Niger as well. The military junta is saying that they're going to transition to democracy in 3 years. And that's happened before in Niger. There's been a military-led government that transitioned to a democratic-led government. So, you know, that's not off the table. If Bazoum kind of isn't reinstated, which it looks very unlikely now that he would be, that really calls into question whether the U.S. will continue its security assistance and other forms of assistance to Niger. Officially, the U.S. has not so far called it an official coup, just an attempted coup. And if the U.S. calls it an official coup, then law prohibits the U.S. from continuing any type of assistance to the government. That would be a significant, I think, blow, again, at the level of humanitarian assistance. And I think that's a really important thing to remember, is that it's the kind of regular citizens of the country who are suffering right now. They are the ones who are being displaced from their homes. Food insecurity is rising. These are, you know, people who are already facing a hardship in terms of kind of getting enough to eat and getting basic levels of healthcare. And so that is sure to continue to get worse. And it just really just breaks my heart to think about the human cost of all of this.
What do you think are the ways the U.S. could most effectively actually help bring more stability, prosperity, security to Niger or to that part of the world generally? Is it a matter of sort of like a dollar figure of international aid? Is it different ways of thinking and messaging about your intervention? What could a country as rich and powerful as the U.S. do?
it goes back to the need to ask the big questions, to reframe the narrative of what's going on from a war on terror approach to a different model. Cost of war research has shown that historically, in over 200 cases that the authors looked at, only 7% of cases of, you know, the terror attacks were resolved by a country's government using military force against those groups that were committing terror attacks. So far more effective have been things like incorporating these groups as actors into the legitimate political sphere and addressing the root causes of their grievances. And we've seen that historically be a way that governments have, you know, stopped the problem essentially of terror attacks. There's also a criminal justice model, which, you know, in the United States, we're very aware that the criminal justice model has its own set of flaws. But, you know, treating someone who's committing terror attacks as a criminal rather than an enemy of the state brings with it a much different way of thinking about the problem and the solutions. And again, people are joining these groups because of structural issues. And so a long-term solution is humanitarian aid and development aid and human rights-based approaches that are going to, you know, kind of answer those problems.
And despite what we all hear about the turmoil and violence that is gripping this region, people in these countries are also solving these problems every day.
There are a remarkable number of local people and groups working on promoting peace in their country. And some of the negotiations that we've seen in Burkina Faso between local governments and the Islamist militant groups that we've seen really work in terms of bringing about ceasefires and stopping local level violence. There are a multitude of government policies that can be carried out to address this problem that get completely obscured and overlooked when the dominant narrative is of a war on terror approach. So that is really, I think, what needs to change. And what the U.S. needs to do is signal very explicitly that this is not the way to solve the problem, and that, you know, there are these other models, and you know, provide the funding and the diplomatic support to back up those alternatives.
So it's not just a dollar figure, it's a reframing of what it means to support.
It is. Yeah, exactly.
Stephanie Savelle, thank you so much for coming on and talking with us on Trending Globally.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
This episode of Trending Globally was produced by me, Dan Richards, and Zachary Hirsch. Our theme music is by Henry Bloomfield. Additional music by the Blue Dot Sessions. If you like Trending Globally, make sure you subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you already are subscribed, please leave a rating and review. It really helps others find us. And better yet, tell a friend about us. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for guests or topics, send us an email at trendingglobally@brown.edu. Again, that's all one word, trendingglobally@brown.edu. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.